The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, a visit with best-selling novelist J. Courtney Sullivan, whose fourth novel, Saints for All Occasions, is a funny, sad book steeped in Irish Catholicism. It's a multi-generational family epic that crosses back and forth between America and Ireland, the past and the present. The plot is punctuated by such nostalgia-producing Catholic devotionals as Holy Cards, the Immaculate Medal, and Prayers and the Catechism Learned by Heart. But there are also such contemporary touches as a lesbian couple selecting their child's father from a sperm bank catalog, plus some cool nuns. Though the author no longer considers herself Catholic, she grants that she's working out the good and bad of her potent Catholic upbringing in her fiction. She's a delight. Then we'll round out the episode with a trip to the Metropolitan Museum of Art's exhibit, Heavenly Bodies, Fashion and the Catholic Imagination, the propriety of which I'm still trying to get my head around. I love art, but papal crowns, stoles, tiaras, and all manner of Vatican bling? Yikes. Granted, a lot of the loot were gifts from royalty, but shall we say the optics are still kind of weird. The show's curator came well prepared to field my snarky observation that maybe a celebration of such opulence isn't exactly in keeping with the style of Pope Francis. Take a listen and see what you think. My view is a bit colored by the fact that, having shaken hands with all of us germy press, our genteel curator turned to his publicist and asked where he could go wash his hands. Speaking of hands, allow me to put mine out during WESU's Spring Pledge Drive, which is in full swing and in need of your help. Please go to WESUFM.org/pledge to donate. And give a shout out to Reasonably Catholic to prove that what I told J. Courtney Sullivan is incorrect. I actually do have listeners. The program is 5 years old now. How about giving any amount with a five in it? Thanks. Up next, J. Courtney Sullivan.
Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Yes, I want to be in that number. Oh, when the saints go marching in.
Welcome, J. Courtney Sullivan.
Thank you for having me.
It's really, I mean, I hope that we don't need more than the hour, but I have so much to talk about. First of all, I want to say that from outside appearances, and I know, as my Italian mom used to say, it's the spoon that knows what's in the pot. Mm. But from outside appearances, you are living the life I dreamed of in my misspent youth.
Really?
Well, you're a novelist. You're published by Knopf. I mean, need I say more? But one thing that I'm discovering as I read about you in preparation for our visit today is that you have a serious work ethic that I will never have.
Oh, I doubt that.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I read that, for instance, let me get my notes up here on my phone. This made me just shrug and say, well, never mind then. Your novel Commencement went through 15 drafts and then three more revisions.
Probably
now,
so, yeah.
Wow. Now, that's impressive.
Thank you. Yeah, in my most recent book, actually, I ended up cutting 900 pages and starting over.
Stop.
Yeah, it is. It's a process of really having to, especially when you're starting off, now that I'm kind of far along into the process, I'm working on my fifth book, and yeah. I am very aware that I'm spending weeks or months writing things that may never see the light of day that I might have to cut.
Yeah.
But I also am far enough along in the process now that I know I can't get to the good stuff until I write the bad stuff.
That's so helpful.
It's kind of okay.
Yeah.
But it's you know, cutting those 900 pages was tough. And Commencement, it's funny now, that's 8 years ago that book came out, and it's kind of like childbirth where you totally forget all the hard parts, and you're like, that was really easy. So when you say that, I'm thinking, oh, I don't remember that, but it's probably the case, yeah.
Oh, man. And so you kill your darlings.
That's right, exactly.
That's right. And also the reference that comes to me is the no plot, no problem approach, you know, that novel in 30 days where you just write and write and write and worry about the editing part later. Have you ever done that?
No, that's interesting.
Yeah, you should check. Well, you don't need to, but for beginning novelists, there's this approach which sounds cheesy, but it's really quite sound, because you know you're supposed to just get it out there and then worry about whether it's good or not later.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I've just started teaching a little bit, and that's something that I say to my students, because and then it's helpful, because what you say to your students as a writer is really, you're also saying it to yourself.
Of course.
And reminding yourself, and it's absolutely the case. I've been sort of telling myself that with the book I'm writing now, that you are your own worst critic as a writer, and mm-hmm. you're always, you know, oh, that's terrible, or should I even keep going with this? And like, so many of my friends are writers, and half our day is spent encouraging each other,
yeah.
That we're not, you know, writing something stupid, and we're not,
wow.
You know, there's something... There's a novelist named Julia Pierpont. She said something so wise. She said, you're never going to accidentally write a novel that you don't care about. So I don't know. That for me was very freeing, because a lot of times it's like, why am I interested in this? Why is this the story I've decided to tell? But there's a reason.
Right. And it's a reason you don't even consciously know, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So interesting. And we're jumping ahead a bit before we really even give you a proper introduction. But since we're near the topic, do you think that's a woman thing, all that self-doubt?
Maybe. You know, I really don't talk to men very much, so I don't know. I live a very female-centric life. You know, I'm married to a man, and I have a son who's 10 months old.
Congratulations.
But, thank you. But it's funny, I'm teaching somewhere else, and they asked me if I knew of any male novelists who wanted to co-teach, and I was like, not really. I know a few who are my friends. And I think the ones who I'm friends with are the types who are as self-critical as women, and maybe that's why I'm friends with them.
Right. Right.
And then, I think it's probably more of like a sort of artist sensibility than necessarily woman when it comes to books, but I also think when it comes to being a woman in general, certainly that is the case.
Okay. Well, let's back up.
Okay.
So, full disclosure, I am coming to your work 4 novels in. I'm embarrassed to admit it, because you're so well-regarded and you've written novels that interest me even. And I don't know how they didn't cross my radar, because I'm, you know, usually tuned in, I like to think. So
that's okay. Thank you.
Well,
I'm happy for people to jump on at any point.
Thank you. So, and we're going to talk at some length about the fourth one. But first, I want to say that I'm interested now in your work, and I feel like the best one for this summer could be Maine. Do you second the motion? as a summer book, you know?
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Maine is very much a sort of, because, you know, it's a lot of the same stuff that I've written in other books about family dynamics and faith and some kind of heavier topics, but it all takes place at a beach house, so there's kind of a loveliness to it.
Exactly. That's what I picked up, that it's beachy and fun for the summer. So, not to say it's light, because I get the feeling you're prone to doing these, what shall we say, sprawling is the word they use, sprawling family dramas.
Yeah, I am. I really love looking at especially women in the context of their historical moment, and in doing that, exploring multiple periods of time in one book. And often if the story is about a family, then that presents different generations of women in one family. And I love sort of cycles and how things stay the same as much as they change.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Saints for All Occasions, because it certainly fits that description generationally. And I just have to say, I listened to it in the car. And it was very well read, and I found myself marveling frequently that you were able so economically to make each one of these family members so alive and real. It's like, how
Thank
is she
you.
Doing this?
Thank you.
Wow. Let's tell the folks a little bit about the plot without giving away too much. I'll let you do it.
Okay. So Saints for All Occasions is the story of Nora and Teresa, two sisters who immigrate from Ireland to Boston in the 1950s. Nora is a sort of very serious older sister, very responsible, and Teresa is kind of the wild younger sister, very romantic and adventurous. And Teresa ends up becoming a cloistered nun, to everyone's surprise.
Yes.
And Nora ends up the matriarch of a large family.
And just may I interrupt to say that, for instance, is a case in point of how you made it believable that Teresa, given her past episodes, would join the convent, but it seemed absolutely like the inevitable thing to happen.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You know, one thing, and maybe I'm skipping ahead and we'll get to this later, but, you know, while I was writing the book, I was spending a lot of time with cloistered nuns.
Yeah.
And I think that if you know someone, if you know members of the clergy, you tend to realize that, you know, they did have very full, interesting lives before they were, not that they're not full and interesting now, but, you know, that they lived in a very particular way, just like anyone else does. I always joke that if you're raised Catholic, then you think nuns are born fully formed in tiny habits. But actually, you know, I had a real education with this book and learning that the nuns who I met along the way were all so fascinating and came from such fascinating backgrounds. So that was something I did want to kind of look at, is that it's not necessarily always the one you might think is going to become a nun who does.
Right.
And, you know, the sisters have this relationship that is very close, but they end up estranged for, I think it's 30 years, and it's the death of Nora's oldest son brings them back together in the present day, and you find out what happened between them and sort of the whole story of this family and how it has unfolded.
Right, and it happens across the big pond. It starts in Ireland and it moves to America. There's a visit back to Ireland. You're Irish, I'm gleaning from your name.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, on the subject of your name, I was interested in reading about you, about the initial thing, the J, initial J, Courtney. Mm-hmm. And that is a kind of Irish tradition, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I think it's very much a Catholic thing. I've heard this from Italian Catholics as well, that in my mother's family, Most of the women for several generations were named Mary.
Mm.
And so in order to tell them apart from one another, they just called everyone by their middle name.
Mm.
So like my mother, her name on official documents is always M. Joyce.
Yes.
So with me, they kept the tradition of the middle name,
yeah,
but did not name me Mary. They named me Julie.
Julie.
So, go figure.
My college roommate was a M, Mary.
Oh.
Yeah. And she was quite Irish. And
yeah,
her last name was Ryan.
Mm,
she married a Shay. So,
oh,
you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm,
the step dancing, the whole works.
Oh, yeah. I did step dancing, too.
I know. I read about that. So, let me ask you, because I read that you're no longer Catholic.
Mm.
Correct?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, is it possible to, I suppose, I'm not a practicing Catholic, that's
okay,
for sure.
Okay.
But I don't know if you can ever officially really not be Catholic, if that makes sense.
It does, and it kind of leads to my next question, which is that do you suppose it's because of that, never being able to get away from it, that you're drawn to writing about it in your fiction?
Yeah. I mean, I am not a religious person, but I am very interested in religion and interested in people who are. I do come from a very Catholic family, and within that family there are varying degrees of devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that's something too when you look at the generational aspect of what I write, that oftentimes in the Catholic faith, you know, previous generation, every decision they made was ruled by what priests said. And,
yes,
and now one or two generations later, maybe some people are still practicing, some are not. Some are raising their kids in the church, some are not. And so I'm very interested in looking at that, too, and how the role of religion kind of shapes people's day-to-day lives.
You are listening to an interview with novelist J. Courtney Sullivan, whose latest book is Saints for All Occasions, a sprawling family epic steeped in the old sod. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. It's our spring pledge drive. Please do the right thing. Go to WESUFM.org/pledge and give what you can. Thanks.
Oh, 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 and they say there's a heaven for those who will wait. And some say it's better, but I say it ain't. I'd rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints. The sinners are much more fun. You know that only the good die.
For me, I have this large Catholic family, and it's interesting because some of my cousins are very young. They're in their early 20s. One is still in college, and they are devout Catholics.
Wow.
Very much so. And so I love, and they're really smart, and I love talking to them about it because have a lot of respect for it at the same time as it's not my practice.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of that? That they're so devout. That they're.
Oh. It's interesting because, like, you know, I come from this family of Boston Irish, and my cousins who are devout, they're very much. They still live in that area. You know, they attended Catholic colleges, and they. Mm. I guess sort of stayed on the path, whereas for me, I live in New York, which to my family it could be Mars because nobody ever moves away.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was just on a slightly different path. I went to Smith College,
which you love,
a family which I loved, and everyone in my family went to Notre Dame or BC, so I was I was weird at every turn.
You were weird. I love the toast. Was it your uncle who raised the toast? That we,
yes.
You tell it.
So, yeah, when my first novel, Commencement, had just been published, and I was writing my second book, Maine, which is about this big, dysfunctional Irish Catholic family from Boston, and so when my own family heard that, they were all very nervous of my uncle, I was on a book tour for a commencement, and so my whole family came out to see me read in Boston. And afterward, we had dinner, and one of my uncles, who's not usually the most effusive man in the world, stood up and said, you know, we're all just so proud of you, and we want to say how much we love you, and it's so important to get this out there now, because a year from now, when your next book, Maine, is published, none of us will ever be speaking to you again.
You know, it reminds me of a quote by Czeslaw Milosz. He said, mm-hmm. When a writer is born into a family, the family is finished.
That's right. Yeah, I would absolutely hate for my child to become a writer, so that's very hypocritical. But my family's been really generous about it, and I think one of the ways that they big hope is my mom always says that I only really write about my father's side, and my father says I only write about my mother's.
So interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, talk about your particular upbringing. It was Mass on Sunday and, I don't know, silence on Good Friday from 12 to 3, I'm guessing.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
What else?
The no meat on Fridays, and certainly went to church every Sunday, went to CCD, you know, First Communion, Confirmation, all of that. So very much raised in the church, and I grew up in a neighborhood, not only a family, but a neighborhood and a town, really, that was very predominantly Irish Catholic, yeah. Milton, Massachusetts. So it was really something that everyone I knew was really steeped in the church.
Mm-hmm. You know, I heard someone say once that Irish Catholicism has a distinctly different flavor than, say, Italian Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
That Irish Catholicism is a little stricter, a little more by the book and rule bound, and Italians are more like, yeah, whatever. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that, you know, nationality has a lot to do with what Catholicism means. My publisher in France, I was there on a book tour, and they're Catholic, and it's a Catholic country, you know, and talking to them about what it means to be Catholic is completely foreign to what my version of Catholic is.
Oh, do tell, do tell.
Well, you know, kind of what you were saying about the difference, I guess, between Italian and Irish, too, is I think the Irish Catholic tradition involves a lot of now I can feel my mother getting mad at me as I say this, but
no, you're among friends.
You know, there are certainly, I think the positive is, let me start with the positive.
Okay.
I think the positive is a real sense, and I still feel like I carry this today, and my husband is also somebody who is a lapsed Catholic, and he's the same way. I think there is a real sense that it is your job to take care of other people, and
yeah.
That, you know, if you see a need, you should fill it. You should do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I take away and I really love. I think there's also an aspect of kind of shame involved in in the teachings. And I think, you know, that there comes on very early. I can remember being absolutely terrified doing my first penance.
Right.
and blanking on my sins, and
yeah.
So I asked the kid next to me what she was going to say, and then I copied her sins. You know, I mean, it's just terrible.
God!
I had another friend who just, she also didn't know what to say. I mean, what are you 7 years old and you're
right.
telling your sins? And so another friend of mine, she just assumed she must have violated most of the Ten Commandments, and so she named the ones that seemed applicable, and one of the things she said was that she committed adultery because she didn't obviously know what that was. So
I have an acquaintance who said that she confessed that sin too as a child because she thought it meant acting like an adult.
Yeah, I think that's probably what my friend thought as well.
Oh, man.
So I think there's something, you know, definitely something I wanted to explore in this book, Saints for All Occasions, and it's very much in my book, Maine, too, which is also about an Irish Catholic family. is the idea of kind of secrecy and shame, and the Irish tradition being one that is equal parts about storytelling and withholding.
So interesting.
And, yeah.
Wow.
And I do think a lot of that comes from how we practice Kabbalah.
Huh. Not to get too personal, but and I know you're a feminist, so I probably can guess, but what, or were there particular issues that made you lapse?
I was always really critical, even as a small child, much to my parents' chagrin. I just, even as just a really young child, like 4 or 5, you know, my parents, I remember them talking about someone in the family going to heaven and describing what that was, and my reaction was just, no, that makes no sense. I'm not buying that. So, and then I think, yeah, as I went along, and I guess I felt there were aspects that were really hypocritical. You know, one of my best friends, parents were very Catholic and they got divorced, and her mother, I would watch her at Mass every Sunday. You know, she'd be there, but she wouldn't get communion because she wasn't allowed to because she was divorced. And I just thought things like that seemed really to kind of not reflect the teachings of what I would assume Jesus would believe in.
Yes.
And certainly, yes, the role of women and attitudes towards things like birth control. I just, my parents, at one point when I was supposed to be confirmed, I was not going to my CCD class. I was skipping confirmation class, and my mother found out. So my poor mother started teaching the class. She had a full-time job, but she also started teaching this class just so she could make sure I went to it.
Oh.
And her thing that she always said to me then was, that someday you're going to want to get married in the church, and so you have to be confirmed, because if you're not confirmed, you can't get married in the church. So part of that same time period, my mother started inviting this wonderful priest, who I still know today, to dinner at our house, and we would have these conversations. But I would be very bold as a 13-year-old and say, you know, why would God care about birth control? Why would God care about divorce?
Yeah,
you know, and these whatever, and there's so many bigger issues in our world and bigger horrors in our world that aren't being addressed, so why that?
Yes, very good.
So yeah, and then I think, you know, the sort of pedophilia scandal for me really took it all over the top and was not something I could ever square, and I still cannot.
Yeah.
You know, in like many other things, it's not just the thing itself, it's the covering up of the thing.
Right, right. No, that's absolutely understandable. And please don't get me wrong, because I am not at all inclined to proselytize or try to bring people into the church, but maybe apropos of this more Italian approach, I mean, it wouldn't be possible to have a kind of Chinese menu approach to it, you know?
My mom always said that. You know, my mom was always very much sort of take what you want and leave the rest.
Yeah.
That's sort of her approach. For me, I think I do that, but I don't necessarily have to call myself Catholic to do it, if that makes sense.
Like, okay.
The aspects, I mean, I sometimes say that I think my household was the one of few places, but actually this probably isn't even true, but that it was a rarity, but that we were sort of taught Catholicism as this matriarchal religion, which is sort of funny, the ultimate patriarchal religion, but the Virgin Mary was so, so important in our household. My mother absolutely loved the Virgin Mary and loves the Virgin Mary, and I do too. I have a Virgin Mary on my windowsill in the kitchen, and I still say a Hail Mary, you know, in any times of trouble. And
it worked, because I asked you to say one when I was pushing some buttons before we began today.
That's right. And the miraculous medal plays a big role in this book, and
yes,
it does in my life,
right,
too. It really was very meaningful to my grandmother and my mother and to me as well. My grandmother gave me one, and I'm sure it's worth pennies, you know, just like a little tiny thing. But it, my grandmother passed away, and I realized that it was missing. And we looked everywhere for it, and I was so upset. My wonderful husband realized that he had been vacuuming, and maybe it had been sucked up by the vacuum, and he had emptied the vacuum bag into the trash. So he ended up going out to our trash outside and taking, you know, 10 trash bags, going through all of them, and he did find the medal, which was amazing.
I love this man.
Kind of thing. I know.
And not just for finding it, for looking and finding, but for vacuuming.
I know.
We right, are lucky. Right. We are lucky wives.
Yes. Every aspect of that story is good. Yes.
Right?
So, you know, that's the kind of thing where something like that happens and you realize, like, oh, this is so important to me. But yeah, I do think there's something about religious objects, you know, that have importance in the church. In the book, there's this deck of holy cards, prayer cards, that plays a big role and moves through this family from one generation to the next, and as it does, it really sort of tells the story of the family. And that was definitely the case in my family, that prayer cards were very important to my grandmother, to my mother, and it was a distant relative who actually gave me the idea to put them in the book, because she told me that when her mother passed away, she didn't want anything, any of her belongings, except her deck of prayer cards.
Wow.
They really told the story of her mother. You know, you could tell which ones had been really used a lot and worn down. And
I
just loved that. So I put that in the book. And with the Virgin Mary statues, I now live in a very Catholic neighborhood, Italian Catholic neighborhood.
In Brooklyn. Brooklyn, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's amazing because when we first moved here, there's a Mary in every yard. And that was very much the case in the neighborhood where I grew up. So I love that. I felt very at home with that. And I have a Mary on my kitchen window still. And shortly after I got her, there was a big storm. And we have these windows that are kind of flimsy and they open in.
Yes.
So you can clean them, I guess.
Okay.
There was a big storm and this huge gust of wind came and the window fell open and I was standing right there. So it, in theory, could have just fallen right on my head, but Mary caught it. It landed on Mary and she held it up. So I think she might have saved my life.
Oh, that's wonderful.
If you are just joining us, this is a visit with J. Courtney Sullivan, author most recently of Saints for All Occasions, which is informed by the author's Irish Catholic upbringing. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. It's our spring pledge drive. Won't you please do your part to support independent community radio, needed now more than ever, as I'm sure I don't have to tell you. Thanks. Is your 10-month-old a girl or a boy?
A boy.
A boy. Now, you're going to have some decision to make about raising the child in a religion, no?
No, I'm not.
No, you're not. Wow.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a thing that when I got married, it was very much a battle.
With the family about the church or not?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, throughout my 20s, I didn't go to church, and I thought that I'd made it kind of clear that that wasn't my thing. But, and it was okay, but it was interesting because once I was getting married and sort of formalizing things, then my mother in particular was very unhappy that I was not getting married in the church.
Oh.
And it was such a drawn-out battle that I think baptism was mentioned once or twice, but it was kind of clear that it wasn't going to happen.
Wow. Well, you know, FYI, your mother probably took Sonny into the bathroom and baptized him already.
You know, I think my best friend's mother did. She came over. She's very Catholic, and she lives in Virginia. And my friend told me that her mother was in New York and wanted to stop by. Mm-hmm. She had made a blanket for my son. And so she came over, and about 10 minutes into being here, began to talk about how she was very disappointed that none of us were raising our children Catholic. And
none of us being who?
Me and my friend and my sister. And so she said, you know, my friend, I think, would just sort of shut her mother down, which is what I would do if it were my own mother. But because it's my friend's mother and I'm well behaved, you know,
yes.
I was sort of like, well, there, and it's true, you know, there are aspects that I really appreciate and will pass on to my son, but there are concerns as well. And so she said, but you know, as I said, I hang out with nuns, so you know, I mean, I'm not totally opposed. She ended up bringing out some holy water from Lourdes and sprinkling it on my son and saying some words, so he may be baptized.
Oh my gosh, that just, I don't know what to say. I don't know. I'm torn. Is this a good or a bad thing?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, though, because I sort of loved it, and she gave me the... This is where it sort of becomes murky, because she gave me the holy water, and I use it. And, you know, when I was trying to get pregnant with my son, my mother told me to go to Montreal and hike up this mountain to the St. Joseph's Oratory and get the oil... And I did, and I used it, and I did get pregnant. And so now when any of my friends are having a hard time, I'm like, here, have some of the St. Joseph oil, and they mostly think I'm nuts.
Oh, my gosh. Did you name your boy Joseph?
I didn't. Maybe I should have. I should have.
That's so great. Yeah, you know, I'm getting the picture of how complicated it is, you know.
Yes, and it's funny. I mean, probably the best example ever was that on my wedding day, my mother and some other family friends, it was very cloudy, and so they hung rosary beads from the trees because we were getting married outside. And then my non-religious friend / bridesmaid finds these rosary beads, and she said, this is weird. Why are these rosary beads hanging in a tree? So she takes them. She assumed they were lost and someone had put them there to say, you know, yoo-hoo, you left these. So she took them out of the tree and brought them to the front desk and said, somebody lost these. And then it proceeded to pour on our wedding.
Stop it!
And so my mother and family friends were saying, how is that possible? We hung the rosary beads, and then come to find out that, of course, this, you know, agnostic friend of mine just removed them. So there you go.
Oh my gosh. Why write fiction? You know what I'm saying?
Right. But and obviously in what we're talking about, there's like a lot of this sort of superstition element, which very much comes from the Irish tradition too, because in the beginning of Catholicism in Ireland, it was very much combined with this older kind of pagan Celtic thing. And so I feel like a lot of that lives on in the way that my family anyway practices Catholicism.
Yeah,
and I'm
interesting.
Sure, there are some Catholics hearing me right now and thinking, this is crazy what she's talking about, but that's very much how it's practiced with at least my mother. I don't think my father would believe in any of this, but my mother, yes.
That's so great. It's really rich. It is. And the stories and the iconography, which you've already talked about, you know, the Mother Mary and the medal and the rosary, some of this you have to introduce your son to.
Oh, absolutely. And it's you know, it's also something like, because I, as I said, with my cousins and my family in general, And you know, I love Thomas Merton, and I I have the utmost respect for deep Catholic thinkers. Mm-hmm. And so I think in my writing, I try to be very balanced.
Yes.
With Saints for All Occasions, there were a lot of readers who read it and assumed that I am a devout Catholic, and so I really liked that. That made me happy, because I think a lot of times people who are not religious don't understand how to have respect for religion, and there's a certain way of talking about the Catholic Church that really sort of makes me cringe, even though I myself am not a practicing Catholic.
And what do you mean?
I think there's just, you know, there to me, a lot of it is, or all of it is really sacred, not because it's necessarily sacred to me, but because it is sacred to someone. And so it's not like rife for mockery, which I feel like, you know, often does happen in popular culture.
Yes, very good. Very good. What a lovely person you are.
Oh, thank you.
So wise and deep and lovely.
Thank you.
What do you think of the Pope?
It's dangerous talking to you because it feels so intimate, and it feels like, oh, I'm just talking to my friend. But
hey,
then it will be
full disclosure, I have no listeners. You're safe.
Perfect. That's great. I don't know. I think in some ways he's great. I think he's better than anything that's come before, at least in my lifetime, so I'm happy about that. But I do sometimes wonder if it's a lot of sizzle and not a lot of steak, I guess I'd say. You know, there's a sort of, I don't know that the reforms that I would want to see happen are actually happening, and certain things are getting lip service, and I don't know.
And you know, I'm on the same page with you.
Yeah.
I'll just say it. He's disappointing.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad to hear you say that.
Oh, absolutely.
I
mean, there are so many things about him that are lovely, but not a lot of moving the ball.
In keeping with the time, that there's a lot of kind of surface level stuff that gets accepted as real progress, and I feel like he's kind of part of that.
Yeah, right. It's a problem.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
And yet, you know, I knew a couple from Boston, very Catholic, very Irish, a lesbian couple, and they love him so much, and they say that he's made it so much easier for them to be, which I don't exactly understand how, but maybe it's more of a feeling thing than it is.
Well, because probably he said almost at the outset, who am I to judge, you know?
Right.
And people are clinging to that like a life raft.
Yeah. To me, it's not at all far enough, but I guess it's better than nothing.
Well, there you go. I mean, and that's exactly how I felt about so many. Don't get me started. It's not about me. So, I am going to pair our chat with a little bit of audio that I gathered up last week recently, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where I'm sure you know, maybe not, there's an exhibit of
Heavenly Bodies.
Heavenly Bodies and the Catholic imagination. And I, by virtue of this show, perhaps fraudulently, got onto the press tour.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, it was just a kind of a sneak peek. I didn't go to the gala or anything, but the press tour was enough.
Because, so how was it? What did you think about
it? You know, jewels, crowns, tiaras, slippers, just a lot of really gaudy Baroque paraphernalia. And in fact, the journalist next to me at one display case full of, you know, rubies and diamonds said, sotto voce, this is why we had the Reformation. You know? And I talked to the curator a bit, and he had kind of a prepared answer to these kinds of snarky observations having to do with the full range of Catholic beauty, and there's the simplicity end of the spectrum, and then there's the ornate end of the spectrum, and let a thousand flowers bloom, in effect. Do you have any thoughts about this? I mean, it does feel to me, I'll just say how it strikes me, kind of tin-eared at this moment to for the Catholics to be showing themselves to be interested in this kind of stuff. We'll just say stuff to be diplomatic.
And strikes me as bizarre.
Bizarre.
Totally bizarre.
Thank you.
Yes. It's funny because when I saw the Met, you know, costume gala this week, I saw all these pictures people were posting on social media, and that the theme had to do with Catholicism. I thought, that is horrific. I was looking at these pictures of, you know, like Sarah Jessica Parker or being the Virgin Mary or whatever they were doing, and I was just like, oh my God, this is horrible. And this was an example of, as I said, something that to me seemed really actually almost sacrilegious and just really in bad taste.
Wow.
And I just, ugh. And then I come to find out that the whole thing is actually, you know, sponsored by the Vatican.
Right.
The Vatican is in on this. I found it very odd.
I'm so glad I asked. Because I kind of, except for that one guy at, you know, who said that about the Reformation, I thought it was me. Everyone else was just blissing out.
I know. It's so strange. It's, really
it's
odd.
Not the aspect of, I mean, especially you as a fan of Thomas Merton, I don't have to tell you, it's not really the deep end of the pool. You know?
Yeah.
And yet.
And that's the Catholicism that I, you know, think is amazing, the Thomas Merton end of the pool.
Yeah.
This end of the pool is what makes me very resistant.
Right.
And the fact that they continue to put it forth is that too.
I mean, and then I say, well, Maria, you like Michelangelo, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the church paid for a lot of amazing art, so fashion is art, and anyway, I just can't get there.
I know, me neither.
J. Courtney Sullivan, I feel like you're a kindred spirit. And
likewise.
That you're like the older person, though, and I'm watching and learning, you know? I feel like after we finish, I'm going to go and revise my unpublished novel 13 more times.
Oh, good. Yes,
yeah.
The 13th time is the charm.
Is that it? Maybe pray a few prayer card prayers.
Yes.
Wow. Well, I'm going to let you get on with your real life, which, I don't know, except for the husband and child part, feels a little almost monastic.
Oh.
Would you say your writing life requires that kind of approach?
Yes. Yeah. And I used to actually, before I was married, you know, I had this little studio apartment that I loved, and it was tiny. And I just, that's what I did, you know, because I had a full-time job. So the time I had for fiction was really the weekend, and I would just like hole up in this apartment. And
your full-time job, we should say, was at the New York Times, right?
Yes, it was, yeah.
So that's not like working at Starbucks. That's
no.
Serious.
That's the thing. By the time I got home from work, I wasn't like, I want to sit down and write a novel. So it really
right.
It happened on the weekends, or it didn't happen. So at a certain point, I decided I needed, my rule was I needed to like talk to one person a day, because I was getting sort of weird, you know, if I didn't talk to anyone for 48 hours. But for the most part, I was sort of holed up alone, and that is still how I prefer to write. And so it's tricky because my husband works from home. I work from home. We have this baby, and we're having another baby. So,
congratulations! That's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah. So the time aspect. So I find that a lot of times the best writing happens at like 1 a.m. because that's the only time that I'm truly alone and it's quiet.
Oh my gosh! I will never be like you. Goodness, you really have it. You've got it bad.
Oh, you're so sweet. You don't know the number of days I waste watching House Hunters, so, you know, that doesn't get into the bio.
That's adorable. Wow. Well, I want to thank you again, really. And good luck with the next book. I can't wait for it to come out. By then, I'll have read all the previous ones, probably, and I look forward to that.
Thank you. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Really fun. Thanks, J. Courtney Sullivan.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And by the way, before we hang up, let me just invite you anytime to come on the show. You want to promote a book? I mean, like I say, I have no listeners, so don't get too excited. But anytime, you just tell your publicist to reach out to me and give me the high sign, and you are
in. I'd love that.
In.
Thank you.
It's great.
That's so nice of you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
That was an interview with novelist J. Courtney Sullivan, who's working on her next novel, so stay tuned. I'll bet she'll come back. Up next, I infiltrate the Metropolitan Museum of Art's press tour for the current exhibit, Heavenly Bodies, Fashion, and the Catholic Imagination, where I got to ask my burning question of curator Andrew Bolton. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Now, Andrew Bolton, curator of Heavenly Bodies, Fashion, and the Catholic Imagination, on view through October 8th at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
Hi.
Maria Johnson.
Hi, Andrew.
Pleasure.
Hi.
Two really quick questions.
Very quick.
He has to go.
So I'm with a program called Reasonably Catholic, okay. Keeping the Faith. And it's a college radio show out of Wesleyan University.
Okay. Oh, wait. Oh, WSU.
Yes.
Oh, that's left. My son went there.
Cut it out. we digress. We'll talk. So just being a little bit of the devil's advocate, because I did hear at least one reporter in the room full of crowns and so on say, well, this is why we had the Reformation, you know. Are you prepared, or did anyone predict any blowback, especially given Pope Francis's famed simplicity?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we reached out to many Catholic communities. We spoke to various spokespeople at the Vatican. I think Cardinal Ravasi, you know, he was extraordinary at the press conference in Rome, how he talked about the different ways to express one's faith and one's relationship to God, one of which is this incredibly lavish, opulent material, and the other side is the opposite side, which is about simplicity. So I think when visitors go up to the medieval cloisters, they'll get to see both sides of the Catholic faith and two ways of expressing one's devotion through either opulence or simplicity.
It's just weird timing with all of the bad stuff in the press about Catholicism to have so much Baroque opulence going on.
I think Benedict talked about it very beautifully, Pope Benedict the 16th, where he talks about how beauty can be the bridge between the believer and the non-believer, and that beauty often is one's first access to God rather than truth or doctrine. But it's beauty that one first experiences as one's relationship to God rather than doctrine. So I think it's a good thing.
Interesting.
All right, well, thank
I'll
you
let
so
you go.
Thank
we'll
you.
We'll have
enjoy
to talk about...
Thanks.
Yes, I will.
So there you have it. I'll post photos from the show along with the audio of the entire episode at the reasonablycatholic.com site. Thanks for listening. I'm Maria Johnson. Please don't forget to give something to the station's spring pledge drive. Any amount with a five in it will nicely mark Reasonably Catholic's fifth birthday. And by the way, during Wesleyan's summer break, I'll be coming to you every week instead of every other week. More bang for your pledge drive buck. Next week's episode, in honor of Memorial Day, will feature the return of our Lincoln expert talking about presidential styles. It'll be Reasonably Catholic, I promise. Now stay tuned for Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.